Hello, and welcome to the Preview Spotlight Interviews on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayer.
And I'm Bob Bretall. In this episode, we'll be talking with creators about upcoming projects available in the current month's previews catalog. Hello and welcome to the Comic Book Page February Interviews episode. First up, we've got Amber Love from AmberUnmasked.com talking to Jonathan Mayberry, who is the creator of a new short story collection and world called V-Wars, in which vampires have come to life based on junk DNA that becomes activated. You'll hear more about it when you hear Jonathan and Amber talk, but this is a very cool short story collection. It's coming out from IDW Comics. It's on page 176 of the previews catalog. It is prose, but it's out through IDW, and it is a kind of fantasy horror topic that's very close to the hearts of many people who read comics. And it's got a great collection of authors, including Nancy Holder, Yvonne Navarro, James Monroe, Gregory Frost, and more, telling stories about the V-Wars. And then next up, I'm going to be talking to Richmond Clements about his all-ages graphic novel called Turning Tiger. And that's out through Arcana Studios and Renegade Arts Entertainment. Hopefully you'll enjoy these. And if you want to hear more reviews and information about comics and comic sales, make sure you visit comicbookpage.com and check out our regular weekly episodes with comics reviews and our monthly episodes where we talk about comic sales and upcoming items from previews.
Hey everyone, it's Amber Love from AmberUnmasked.com. Joining me today is Jonathan Mayberry to talk about V-Wars. Hey John, thanks for coming.
Hi Amber, thanks for having me on.
Now, let's just cover some real basic questions here. Is this a graphic novel or is this prose?
This is prose. Even though IDW, the publisher, is a comic book company, they've launched a prose line, and this will be the third or fourth book, I think the fourth book in that line of novels. Of collections or anthologies.
Of anthologies. Okay, I love IDW. It's one of my favorite publishers. Your experience with them so far has been really good?
Yeah, I my first experience with them was through a G.I. Joe anthology that Max Brooks edited a couple years ago. And I had a great time, and I had so much fun working on the project that the editor, the house editor of that, asked me to pitch an idea to him, and I pitched V-Wars, and we're having a blast.
Now, it's called V-Wars, and V meaning vampire. Yeah. So why did you decide to put out a vampire book right now?
Well, I got my start when I switched to fiction after being a nonfiction writer my whole life. My first three novels were vampire novels. Ghost Road Blues, Dead Man's Song, and Bad Moon Rising was a vampire trilogy. And I've written six books on folklore, focusing mostly on the folklore and legends of vampires. So it's a world I know very well. And I wanted to do something where we got away from the happy romantic vampire back to the vampire roots, which is they're monsters. And that's what our original intention was, to make vampires scary again. And V-Wars grew out of that concept. But at the same time, it also has a different spin to it, in that it's scientifically based. The vampires in this are not supernatural. The gene for vampirism exists in all DNA. But a virus is released from melting polar ice, and it triggers the gene. And some people start becoming whatever vampire was part of their own ethnic or cultural background. So a Chinese person, for example, would become a Jiangxia. Scandinavian person would become a Draugr, et cetera. So you have different types of vampires happening.
Okay, and besides vampires, though, can that gene sequence open them up to becoming some other kind of creature?
Well, we touch on werewolves in the book, but they're definitely vampires. I mean, that's the principal monster in this. And there's so many different types of vampires. There's hundreds of different species of vampires according to folklore. And so we start seeing all of those species emerge around the world. And you have what boils down to a race war between humans and vampires, which allows us to explore a lot of ethical issues, like if we're fighting them and they're a species now, is destroying them ethnic genocide, even in self-defense? It becomes a very complex issue.
It indeed does. I know Scott Snyder, as far as modern comics go, has also brought back the notion that the vampire is a monster, yeah, as opposed to, you know, gothic romance. And
Justin Cronin touches on that in the passage. There's a few that are doing it. It's kind of almost the a backlash, because we've had romantic vampires for so long now that it's not that, you know, I have an objection to romantic vampires. It's just that, you know, we've been there, done that for too long, and it's not the folklore. So this is kind of retro vampires in a way.
So you're covering everything from, like, chupacabra to, you know,
yeah, we have a bunch of different vampiric types in there, that's for sure. There are only 8 stories in this book, and we're hoping that it becomes a series. So, you know, this book covers 8 different species of vampires, including the Jiangxia, the Chinese hopping vampire, and a few others. And make reference to other emerging vampires that normally a person, you know, people who aren't familiar with vampire folklore wouldn't consider to be vampires, like some of the vampires who are not blood drinkers but are flesh eaters, or those who feast on essence like human energy or breath and so on. And there's a lot of different vampiric types around the world, so we have a little of everything.
So that notion of psychic vampire, I thought that was something that was modern. You're saying that you discovered that in your research?
Oh, there's the thing is, in vampire folklore, only a third of the world's vampires are hemophagous, you know, blood drinkers. About a third are flesh eaters as well. But really, a third or more are what are called essential vampires, which include psychic vampires. Vampires who take something, whether it's life breath, energy, sexual energy, psychic energy, you know, those types of energetic vampires exist in cultures around the world. There's even one type of vampire that feeds on faith. So there's lots of different types of vampires, and that plays into our story, because it's easier to build a case for psychic ability than it is for supernatural ability. So a psychic vampire would fit very well in V-Wars.
So these stories, that you have an anthology here, so is this one continuous story picked up by different writers, or is this independent stories?
A little of both. It's a shared world thing, kind of like the Wild Card series that George R. R. Martin edited. I created the world of E-Wars, and each of the writers writes a story set in that world. Some of the stories have a fairly strong connection to one another. Some have a more loose connection, but they're all set in that world. And it covers about a 6-month period or so between the initial outbreak, the patient zero of the plague, to a crisis point that is our ending point for this story. But they are all in the same world. And we had some discussions back and forth, you know, about how to fit them all into that world. So it's one big unhappy world.
Do you have a very clear protagonist here? Like, is there a hero, or is it more and you brought up ethics, so is it more a matter of the reader chooses sides versus you make it very clear who you want your hero to be?
There's a character named Luther Swan, who's the point of view character for a framing story. My story, Junk, is broken up so that it frames all the other stories. So we keep returning to Luther Swan, who is a folklorist and vampire expert, and he's the moral center of the book. He doesn't believe in a race war, but at the same time, he's saying how dangerous these characters are. In each of the other stories, there's a different protagonist. I mean, Swan may be mentioned, but they're not all Luther Swan stories. There's no central hero, and there's a lot of nebulous ethical ground for people to stand on. So we don't say hate the vampires or support the vampires. It's like, this is a complex, essentially political issue, you know, and we let the reader decide where they want to stand. I guide a little bit of it to an ethical discussion of what do we do when we're at war with a component of our own human race. And that opens questions that we hope the readers will respond to and answer themselves.
Now, this might be pure coincidence, but can you tell me why you chose the name Swan for Luther? Because I haven't read them, but I know in Twilight, the central character is named Bella Swan. And in my, like, current favorite show right now is Once Upon a Time. And our star hero's name is Emma Swan.
Yeah, I've had the character of Luther Swan in my head probably for 35 years. I have always, you know, long before I started writing fiction, I was always coming up with characters, and there were two or three characters that for some reason just been in my head. So Luther Swan was one. I wanted to do a story that was of a scientist hero, and that, you know, for some reason that name came up. The name, I chose Swan at the time because it was the last name of a close friend of mine, and Luther because it was the first name of another friend of mine. So that's where the name came from. Way before, probably before Stephanie Meyer was born.
Was born, probably.
And certainly before, long before Once Upon a Time was dreamed up. So I've had the character for a long, long time, and I like the name that fits the character. You know, it sounds scholarly, but at the same time, it doesn't sound hard-edged.
I agree. That's why the name always struck me when I heard Emma Swan. I was like, wow, that is a fantastically chosen name.
Yes.
You know, because it has grace to it.
It does. It does.
So what sort of powers or weaknesses do the vampires in your world have?
Well, that varies because each vampire species has different abilities. The first vampire we meet is a fairly standard English or French revenant type vampire. You know, it's not a living dead, but it's someone who has those powers. He's stronger, he's faster, but he also has blackouts where he becomes very savage. And he's also somewhat cannibalistic, which fits the Croque and a few other of the French vampires and some of the English vampires. But there are different vampires in the story, some of which are much stronger, some of which actually have no superpowers other than a compelling appetite. So it becomes a defining characteristic of their behavior rather than giving them, you know, supernatural powers or superpowers. And there are some that we allude to that may become, that they are afraid may become enormously uncontrollably strong. But we keep it grounded pretty hard in science too. You know, you don't have a character who, like there are some vampires in folk where they're able to cause eclipses and things, you know, that's not possible. So we don't do that. We don't have a vampire turning into a bat, which by the way is not found in folklore. Vampires don't turn into bats in folklore.
So that was a Hollywood
creation? That was
Bram
Stoker. Bram Stoker put a lot of stuff in there that wasn't in vampire folklore. The whole thing about
he himself, I mean, is a folklore following at this point.
Stoker was a writer, and he was not a very deep folklorist. His research notes, by the way, are here in Philly at the Rosenbach Museum. They're interesting to read. But you know, he added the thing about a vampire needing to bite a human, and they bite. You know, they drink his blood back and forth for a 3-day conversion to vampirism. That was entirely his invention. He being an Irish Catholic, he wanted to create something that was a perversion of the ritual of communion, of drinking Christ's blood and then eventually, you know, rising from the dead after 3 days. It's never in folklore before for the Stoker. The thing about a holy object warding off a vampire, generally not in folklore. Usually there are things like herbs and garlic wards vampires off, but holy objects don't for the most part. And even the thing about a vampire not being able to enter unless invited, Stoker had to come up with that because he, in the first third of Dracula, he made the character so powerful that when he got to England, he had to figure a way to limit him. Otherwise, he was just going to kill everybody. So he had that whole thing about the vampire couldn't enter unless invited. Whereas in actual Romanian and Hungarian folklore, you can't keep a vampire out unless you protect the house with, you know, garlic mash around the windows and so on. So a lot of what we have in our mind about vampires comes from the fiction that Bram Stoker created. And the thing with sunlight, I mean, that was invented for the movie Nosferatu. That was never in folklore before. Even Dracula walks around during the day. But when they were filming Nosferatu, they ran over budget, and half the crew had walked off the set. They needed to finish the film, and the only, you know, they couldn't film the big ending they planned. So the lighting guy suggested that they just simply use sunlight because they had shot so many scenes of the vampire hiding in darkness. And now that's part of vampire folklore.
What about mirrors?
In some cases, you know, because in a lot of beliefs, vampires are ghosts. I mean, like even the word Strigoi means ghost. So vampires technically are manifesting a body, but they aren't real. And that's alluded to quite a few times in Dracula. The stake is another thing, by the way. Stakes were never used to kill vampires. They were used to hold a vampire down, usually a long spear-like stake, so that the ritual of exorcism could be performed. But it wasn't.
I thought that the stake was particularly part of a burial to keep them, to keep people from coming back out. I was going to ask you, because your vampires are based on science, how you looked towards things like consumption or porphyria, things that we know as real diseases.
Yeah,
and keeping the stake through the body was, you know, at the time they, you know, those people were victims of consumption, and it was an attempt to
pretty much keep anybody down at that point.
Keep them down.
Yeah. Iron nails were more commonly used than stakes to nail the vampire into the coffin. But a lot of diseases are behind the legends of vampires. Sudden infant death syndrome is behind a lot of vampire beliefs. You know, put a healthy baby to bed, next morning it's dead. There's no marks on it, so they believe something came in and stole its breath, drank its breath. And that's, you know, that was the explanation for sudden infant death syndrome for years. But if you look at the word Nosferatu, Bram Stoker made a mistake when translating that word. He translated it as undead, which it does not mean. The word Nosferatu means plague carrier. And most of the vampires, especially of Eastern Europe and Central Europe, were invisible spirits who spread diseases. They were, you know, a way for people who didn't understand science or bacteria or viruses to explain why after a body was buried, sometimes people would die. Well, improper burial procedures lead to bacteria and other things that could infect the local population. So there's a lot of scientific basis. I've written a number of nonfiction books on this subject, and you can explain most of it away. But we're going with the ones that you can't explain away were actually a genetic offshoot of the human race that just simply gave a certain set of qualities, you know, into people. And the last people to have those qualities present as a vampire were hunted to extinction. And now the gene is coming back triggered by a virus.
So you have it because of where the ice caps and or something, isn't that right, is melting in Antarctica?
Yeah.
Is your environment actually set in America or North America, or is it?
Yes,
just...
but the patient zero of the plague was shooting a film in the Arctic. He's an actor.
Okay.
Was infected there, and he's the one that brings the disease back with him. He becomes the Typhoid Mary, the patient zero of that plague. And with the movements of world populations, something like a disease can be spread very fast, very far. And since it's a genetic disorder, it would be years before it would present in the population. So by the time he actually manifests the symptoms because of his own genetic changes, it's been years since he's been back from the Arctic, and now the plague is everywhere.
So when it comes to something that's so scientifically based, what does that mean to something like the economy? I mean, here I'm in New Jersey, you're in Philly. We are in like the hot spot of pharmaceutical companies, if you will, as far as our country is concerned.
Yes.
What would something like vampirism actually do? Wouldn't that tremendously bolster the pharmaceutical economy?
Absolutely. In fact, one of the things providing this goes to a second book, one of the things we're going to explore in, I think, two of the stories, if we go to a second book, would be the effect on the economy, the post-outbreak economy. Pharmaceutical companies would make a fortune. I worked for a pharmaceutical company for 5 years, and they're not upset when there's an outbreak of something. It's a marketing opportunity. On one hand, you think, wow, that's really a terrible way of looking at things. From their point of view, yeah, but they're the ones to provide a product for that. And ethics aren't really involved. It's marketing. I think ethics are involved in everything, but they don't. They're selling a product. But they would profit heavily, as would the press. The press always profits. And, you know, in the recent movie Contagion, we saw some of this played out. They even discuss it. Max Brooks discusses it a bit in World War Z as well.
So why did you choose the contributors that you have in this book?
Well, I know all of their writing very, very well. And a couple of them are good friends of mine who I've worked with on a number of projects. And I wanted to bring a variety of storytelling voices to it. I didn't want people who had only written vampire stories. Like Gregory Frost, I brought him in because he's a folklorist. And I wanted him to write the story that closes the book, where we take it to the next level and open another unpleasant door. And I'm not going to spoil it, but he was the right man for that job. Nancy Holder, you know, her ability to tell a fantastical story and ground it in the real world is marvelous. So, you know, she was an easy pick. And all the others, I know they're writing, and they're so substantially different from one another that in a shared world story, having all those different voices, makes the book what I envisioned. Essentially world voices in a way, just radically different voices.
Can we expect there to ever be a graphic adaptation or pitch?
We are in discussions with the folks at IDW for that. And since, okay, several of us write comic books, I write for Marvel. Keith DeCandido is a practiced comic book writer, and I think Nancy's written some too. We're very likely to go into either graphic novel or maybe a continuation of the story as a comic book. That's a possibility as well.
That'd be great. It's almost like I thought maybe we had hit a saturation point with vampires, but then every once in a while you get truly surprised by the quality that's out there. Do you have a favorite of work that's out there right now?
I do, but I just want to make a comment about the saturation thing. They say this about vampires and they say it about zombies because...
Yeah.
The press usually are the ones who start saying that. They usually wind up making an unintentional joke. Vampires are dead. No, they're not. The genre may wax and wane, but like any storytelling trope, it will always be reborn as soon as there is a new good story to tell. I'm sorry, the phone is ringing in the background, we got it. Sorry. As soon as there's a new story to tell, it gets reborn again. Like, for example, we thought that after Dark Shadows was canceled on TV and, all the vampire Hammer films were starting to wind down, we thought that vampires were gone. And then Stephen King wrote Salem's Lot and Anne Rice wrote Interview with a Vampire. Suddenly they were huge again. That all settled down after a while. And then Buffy the Vampire Slayer came on. That settled down after a while. Then we got Twilight. Then we got True Blood. If somebody comes along with a new story, there's always going to be a resurgence of it. We're seeing it with zombies now. We've seen it with vampires. Trope's never going away. As far as what my favorite goes, that's a hard call because I've been mostly immersed in zombie fiction recently because I'm writing a lot of that and reading a lot of it. But the books that I've most enjoyed in terms of vampires of recent years a friend of mine who just passed, Leslie Banks, L.A. Banks, wrote this brilliant Vampire Huntress series, and I've read the series twice, and I just recently finished it again, and that I thought was one of the best vampire series in years, just so brilliant. And she had a great werewolf series too, Crimson Moon series, and I thought that was a fresh voice, a lot of action, and also she was an amateur folklorist and brought a lot of interesting things to that. And those books are, certainly still in print.
I mean, she made her mark in comics as well.
She did. She did. And Leslie was a good friend of mine for 40 years. We met in middle school. And she was a member of the Liars Club also, the group of writers. But I thought she brought the freshest voice to vampire fiction. But there's tons of great stuff out there, old and new.
So what we're looking at right now, and the reason that we're talking about vampires to such a great extent, is because V-Wars is in this month's previews. It's on page 176 from IDW. And, you're doing like some sort of online tour.
Yes.
Which is quite extensive.
Yes.
So for the entire month of February?
Yeah, that's for Dead of Night, my latest zombie novel. I'm doing a 46-day blog tour. And that'll fold into two other blog tours. One for V-Wars, which the eight of us will be involved in. The eight writers will be involved in. But I've also got a second vampire book coming out that same month in April. A book called Assassin's Code, which deals with genetically engineered vampires, and it's the fourth book in my Joe Ledger series, and that comes out just about the same time as V-Wars.
So will you be doing any sort of conventions? The typical comic book tour, is hitting things like, New York and San Diego and Wizard World. And so what do you do to promote V-Wars?
Well, we're going to be doing some stuff at some signings in New York. We're working on the dates right now. I'll be hitting probably LunaCon, PhilCon, maybe Balticon in our area here on the East Coast. I'm going to be doing something with it. Several of us will be at DragonCon in Atlanta over Labor Day weekend, which is something I never miss. We're in discussions now for a couple of comic book conventions too. But a lot, some of this stuff is set up kind of last minute once they landed on when they were going to put the book out, that, you know, which is coming out actually pretty soon. You know, we just wrapped it. It's coming out pretty soon. Comic book companies work faster than regular book publishers. So we're now in the process of locking down where we're going to be to promote this. And that'll be all over my blog and all over the blogs of the other participants.
Why don't you give us your key websites then, like your blog and your Twitter?
Okay. Well, my blog site is my name. It's jonathanmayberry.com. And Mayberry is M-A-B-E-R-R-Y. And jonathanmayberry.com. And that also links to my Twitter, which is my name, and my Facebook, which is also my name.
Okay.
And I'm pretty much everywhere on the net. And most of the other contributors are pretty heavily invested in social media as well. And usually I buzz things out on Twitter and Facebook, and we'll be launching a couple of blogs right before the book comes out, where we'll be sharing the folklore and some of the science. And by the way, the introduction to the book is going to be written by Dacre Stoker, who is the great-grandnephew of Bram Stoker.
That is so awesome.
Yeah. And he's a heck of a nice guy, too.
How did that work out? How did you find that?
I know him. We met at the Bram Stoker Awards, and we've become friends. And he's just a remarkably good guy and very supportive of the V-Wars project, which is just wonderful. We didn't need the Stoker family to support us, of course, but having that support is an incredible thrill and an honor too.
Now, one final question before we wrap up. You have a diverse group of contributors on V-Wars. So I was wondering if you noticed in particular a difference in the gender of writers handling the subject. Do you find that female writers are more or less romantic, or, you know, because I know it's been a thing in comics in the whole past year has been talking about how, you know, women writers are, you know, neglected. And yet, you know, True Blood and Twilight are, you know, two of the top selling authors of all time.
Yeah. And that's an interesting thing. I agree that women in comics are neglected. I really think there's so much that we can, so many fun areas to go and so many interesting areas to go in if we just simply embrace more of diversity in comic books. And it's not just women. I'd like to see, there are a lot of black comic book writers who never get in the mainstream, a lot of Asian comic book writers who never get in the mainstream. You know, it's open the doors for everybody, whoever tells the best story. But in terms of V-Wars, you know, we have two female contributors, Nancy Holder and Yvonne Navarro, and neither of them really go heavy into the romance. They're both really concentrating on stories about being a little different, you know, taking a different view of things. So rather than a romantic element, I think they bring in a stronger outside the box, you know, more of a fresh perspective than you might get with you know, all male writers in a book. So it brings a lot of balance to it. Leslie Banks was going to be one of the contributors, by the way. She had started a really great story, and it was probably the last thing she wrote before she passed, the opening of a story set in Egypt. And at some point, I want to talk to her daughter about getting that story and maybe finishing it, hopefully for the next V-Wars book.
That would be a wonderful addition, because, you know, what an impact she made.
My God, yeah. she was amazing, and a great humanitarian, and just one of the true good guys in this world. You know, just one of the best.
All right, Jonathan, thank you so much for your time, and, you know, I wish you the best of luck on V-Wars and the other books coming out.
Thanks so much, and, you know, keep your doors locked, because those things are out there.
All right, thanks a lot. This is Amber Love from AmberUnmasked.com, and now back to the guys in the studio.
I am now talking to Richmond Clements, who is the writer and creator of a graphic novel from Renegade Arts Entertainment. It is called Turning Tiger, and you're joining me all the way from Scotland. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you for having me, Bob.
Let's talk about Turning Tiger a little bit. Why don't you give the listeners kind of a high-level feeling of what the story's about and where it's set in the action?
Yeah, the story is essentially the story of a giant war robot that malfunctions and goes off to do its own thing, and kidnaps a 9-year-old girl in the process of its malfunctioning. And then the military, of course, are then have the problem of getting this robot back, trying to save the girl and trying to stop the girl's parents going to the press and revealing everything that's going on. So yeah, and it's, you know, action-packed and stuff like that.
So this is kind of a, this military robot thing, this is more of like a secret program. They're not like on the news, hey, we're making giant war robots.
Yeah, yeah.
Why they want to keep it quiet.
Yeah, right? It's a top secret military program. There's three of them they have, and this one in particular malfunctions. And we, during the course of the story, we find out why.
Now, you are working with artist Alex Moore. Why don't you talk a little bit about your relationship with Alex, some of the design elements of the series, and how the two of you work together?
Yeah, certainly. I'd originally pitched and sent the script in, and they were accepted. And Alex Fimbo, it's two Alexes, this will get confusing. My editor emailed me and says, we found this artist, Alex, and have a look at her work. And he sent me at the back of the book, we have a double page spread of her original design drawings. And that was the first thing I'd ever seen. And when I seen it, I went, yeah, absolutely. She's nailed 90% of the characters from the off. There were a couple of things I asked for tweaks for, but most of the, pretty much all of the design work's hers. So she takes credit for the cool looking robots. The only change I asked was, she had her original robot design had it, and this is something that annoys me in things like Transformers, where these are battle robots, yet they have their wires and gears hanging out, you know? So I asked her to cover everything up, and once she'd done that, I was completely happy with what she'd done.
Oh, just kind of harden it a little bit so it's not going to be catching stuff on the stray edges.
It drives me nuts when I see that in Transformers. And this is meant to be a military vehicle, you know, but it's all its insides are showing. But anyway, that's just me.
So when you're working, do you work full script or a different kind of style?
Oh, no. I write a panel by panel breakdown. Each script, yeah. But having said that, my scripts, I don't write like Alan Moore. You know, I don't have 4 or 5 paragraphs or a page for each panel. You know, it's usually 1 or 2 sentences of description, because the way I see it, it's not my job to tell an artist what to draw. I'll tell them what I need in the panel, and I'll tell them what the characters are feeling or thinking and saying at the time, but everything else is the artist's job, you know.
Right, so you're not going to the level of, you know, specifying camera angles and all this kind of stuff. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, if I have a particularly strong opinion on what something should look like, I will, but I very, very, very rarely do, you know.
Now, when the story's done, this is just another thing that I'm kind of curious about now that everything, you know, we're kind of digital and, you know, it can be emailing files back and forth. When Alex Moore is doing the art, does she do breakdowns or pencils or something and then send you those, or do you not see the art until it's in more of a finished form?
Yeah, sometimes for other projects I've worked on I have, but on this one, no, I didn't see it until it was finished. And I was fine, you know, it was because I know Alex, the editor, is pretty thorough, you know, and I know he's going to do that, and he sent me the finished pages, and yeah, I think there were maybe 1 or 2 things I needed changed towards the end, but no, it was pretty much 95-99% finished when I seen it. And this, I should point out, was Alex's, her first comic too. So, and the level of work she's put in for her first work is incredible.
Now, is she doing the coloring on this also?
She did, yeah. There's one piece, one of the front pieces, I think, Simon Colby's, was colored by my partner, Vicky Stonebridge. But yeah, she's done her coloring in her own work, yep.
Cool. And do you know, just procedurally, I mean, is she working digitally on this, or is she doing traditional on paper and then scanning it in?
I think, I'm not 100%, but I think that's what she did, because my partner and I run a comic convention here in Scotland, and a couple of years ago, Alex is one of the guests, and she was sitting in her downtime coloring the pages of Turning Tiger you know, during the convention. So,
so
I
physically,
was,
so it's not like done in Photoshop.
Well, no, she was doing it on Photoshop.
Oh,
at
she
the
was.
Convention.
Oh,
yeah,
so she had like an iPad or a laptop.
I was over her shoulder making sure she was doing it correctly, you know. So yeah, it was good.
Digital is, you know, it's really changing the medium. I mean, there's like huge pluses to it, you know. You
can, oh yeah,
like,
yeah.
Go back and change things, you know. It's not like you're trying to erase.
Yeah, that was which came to her advantage at one point where I'd asked for a change early on in episode one to a page that Alex had already finished and colored, you know. So she was able to go in digitally and change, completely change the page. I mean, I needed a new panel dropped in. So yeah, it's very, very useful thing, the digital stuff.
Yeah, very cool. So you were mentioning to me before we started recording that you are planning a sequel to Turning Tiger.
Yes.
What can you tell us about that without any kind of spoilers?
Oh, that's a good question. It was, maybe a year ago or more ago, Alex Fimbo, my editor, emailed me and said, so can you write a sequel? And I immediately said yes. And it was only after I'd said yes, I went, oh, what am I going to write about? Because I genuinely, even though people have said, and there are, you know, there are plot threads left hanging at the end of this, but I had never intended to have a sequel. So it took me maybe a year to get to a point where I was happy with the storyline for the sequel, which I'm about to write now. A lot of the time was spent, you've read it, so you'll probably know what I'm talking about here. I've got one character that appears in it for two panels. There's a panel in the first half and a panel in the second half. And I was obsessing for an awful long time over that character and who they were and what they were doing in their relationship with everybody else. And it was only after literally 4 or 5 months of going on, of thinking about that, I realized that's not what the story's about. It's about a giant robot and a little girl. So once I got back to that, I've got the storyline for the segment all sorted out, but I can't tell you anything about what happens in the plot without spoiling the first book, I'm afraid.
Right, which is fine. I don't want to see spoilers. Now, let's talk a little bit about the decision. You know, when you're sitting down to write this, I'm imagining that, I mean, this basic story that you're telling here could be told in a bunch of different ways.
Yes.
And the way that you've chosen to tell it is in really an all ages kind of way. And when I say all ages, I mean that in that sense of the term, that, I mean, I read this and I didn't feel like I was being talked down to, like it was written targeted at kids, but at the same time, it's written where it's completely appropriate. I mean, you could give this to a 9-year-old girl who would completely identify with the girl in the story.
Good.
And there's nothing, you know, there's nothing wrong with this. You know, this could be told in a way that, you know, you have people getting their limbs ripped off and, you know, all kinds of, you know, horrible stuff happening and language and other kind of things. Mm-hmm. You've chosen to tell it in an all ages fashion. So two points there. And that is, you know, your thought process there and who you'd really like to see picking up this book and how we can get this into the hands of, for instance, younger girls, because I think that, you know, they could really get a lot out of this kind of story.
Yeah, I would love that to be so. But I didn't set out to write an all-ages story. I just set out to write a story. It just happened to be, when it finished, it happened to end up being an all-ages book, which is brilliant. And I know I've got two children of my own. I've got two boys who are 14 and 9 and or 10, and they've both read it and both love it, you know. Well, they tell me they love it. But yeah, so yes, it would be ideal. I know, and Alex the editor has got two girls too, and they're both fans of the book, and he has said they both want to know what happens next. They want to know what happens to Sarah, you know, who is the young girl in the story. So yeah, I would love it to see that, but as I said, it just happened to be all ages, which is good, you know. I'd love to see more children reading comics, and if this gets them in, it will. And there are elements, as you know, which will appeal to adults, which children won't get. I like to think that below the surface of the story, there is a pretty dark layer going on in the book, which children will necessarily not grow up or pick up on, but adults will.
Yeah, particularly with that that guy on the military side, you know, yeah.
Yeah.
I know exactly who you're talking about.
Yeah, yeah. Good.
So another question that occurred to me, and this is in the design of the three robots.
Mm-hmm.
We have the red, yellow, blue color scheme to the three robots, mm-hmm. As opposed to, you know, a lot of times you'll find these stories where you got these giant, you know, kind of mecha robots, and they either look wildly different, you know, like Transformer, you know, mm-hmm. taking a cue off of Transformers, but that's not realistic from a, you know, realistic, right? From a standpoint of like a military program, they're not going to come up with three completely
different... No, they're going to build them from the same template,
you know, Right, exactly. But a lot of times they're just, you know, like if I go out to a military base and they've got three planes, they're not three completely different colors. They just have a different, you know, tail number on them or an ID number. So what was the thought process there? And, you know, what was your contribution to that versus Alex's contribution? Because I think it works better visually, you know, for the purposes of the story, because you got that color cue to tell them apart more so than just having a number or something.
I think from memory, that's exactly the reason I specified in the script that they were red, yellow, and blue, solely so they could be told apart, and so that when I was describing them in the script, I would say the red one, the blue one, and the yellow one. I think that was the only reason, my only thought process behind that. But yeah, if it works in another level, that's great. Yeah.
But that's great, because, you know, it's the kind of thing where it does make it a little easier in the action panels, you know, for telling them apart. And it's the kind of, you know, would that actually be the case in a military one? Well, you know,
probably not.
Who cares? You know, for the purpose of the story, it works a lot better this way.
They'd probably draw a number on their back or something, which wouldn't be as cool for us. But hey,
right. So you're from Scotland.
I'm from Ireland. But I live in
Scotland. From Ireland. Okay, yes. You're living in Scotland.
Yeah.
What was your what went into the process to set this in America as opposed to setting it over where you are, other than the fact that we're you know, renowned for our warmongering ways over here?
your words, Bob, not mine. I think, well, I would put
James
it in...
James Bond has all kinds of cool stuff.
Yeah, but his is cool stuff he keeps in his pocket. You know, he doesn't have... And I am writing a story at the minute with that sort of thing in it. But back to Turning Tiger, it was always set in the... Particularly because I'd always seen the big fight in the first issue in the desert. And I think it was natural to have... Great Britain isn't big enough to hide something like three giant war robots and to test them without anybody seeing them. Whereas over there, you guys got plenty of wide open space in the middle of the Nevada or wherever, I think is where I've set the base, a practical reason. Also, from want of a better word, a realistic point of view, the British government just wouldn't have the money, wherewithal, or talent to build they probably have the talent, but they wouldn't have the finances or will to build machines like that, whereas from at least our outside perception, the US military would.
That makes sense.
Yeah. Phew.
Let's talk about our hopes for getting this into people's hands. I mean, so it's in previews. It's from Renegade Art, so it's going to be in the back half of previews.
Yeah.
If people want to see this book, I definitely think that they're going to need to go to their comic shop now and, you know, kind of tell the people, hey, you know, I really, you know, I'm interested in this book. Can you please order it for me? Because unfortunately, this is the exact kind of stuff that tends not to get ordered on speculation to be on the rack at most comic shops, although there are a handful of comic shops that do have a good selection of things like this. If you're hearing stuff here that makes this sound cool to you, and especially if you've got younger kids, and I would say if you've got, you know, a young girl in, you know, this age range, this would be a story that I think they'd really enjoy.
Oh yes, and I've been telling, but you can order it from the Renegade Arts website, or you can buy it on Amazon, but it would help so much if people would go into their local comic shop and ask for it, because it gets the book on the shelf and the comic shop will hopefully order a couple of extra issues and, you know, somebody else can buy it. So please, right. Yes, I beg you.
Yeah, that's our common lament, you know, is that we want to try to get some variety into the shops. And they're talking about, you know, why is the readership of comics declining? You know, it's like, well, you know, think of people my age, you know, it's like, when did I start reading comics? I didn't start reading comics as an adult. I myself started reading comics when I was 8 or 9.
Yeah.
And, you know, you got to get kids that are that age, you got to put books into their hands that they think are cool, that appeal to them, and then they can grow up with comics and go to different kinds of books as they progress, you know, into, you know, older, more mature reading levels. But, you know, boy, I just think that there's this middle ground of comics that we're really missing stories that have a wide, broad appeal.
Yeah, and this is a perfect book to put into the hands of a, you know, 9-10-year-old, because it's not that long. It, you know, it's not, the story, while being complex, is not complicated. So, yeah, and they're able to read it, and they'll get a lot from it. So, yeah. Please. I know Alex, the editor, uses it in schools when he goes on school visits and stuff. So, yeah.
I think that's great, you know, because there's a lot of comics that seem, I won't say a lot, you know, there are several comics that seem to be targeted at a younger audience. And I'm talking, you know, 5-6-year-old type things that are a little more cartoony. They're not necessarily telling, you know, this kind of a story. And then there are, of course, you know, the ones that are targeted at teens and older. But there's that middle ground in there that's missing. And this one slots right in there.
Yeah, and we don't seem to have comics for that grind, though. Hopefully I'm filling a part of it. But in, you know, in prose novels, you've got J.K. Rowling and Roald Dahl and people like that. You know, if you look at that, you know, those are all ages books, but they're written, you know, so we have it in novels. Why not in comics?
Exactly. So I want to thank you for taking the time with me. I want to thank you for writing something for this overlooked demographic of our comics community. And I want to urge listeners to get the word out on it and check it out. And especially, you know, if you've got kids in this range or you know somebody with kids in this range, start thinking about pointing them at Turning Tiger.
Yeah, please do. And if you're on Facebook, we have a Turning Tiger Facebook page. People can join up and post questions. I'll answer questions there for them and stuff. So yeah, please do.
Okay, great.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.